Richard Minotaur is back in Montana. Richard, first off, it's an honor to have you back on the program. Good to see you again.
Well, it's an honor to be here in this over-caffeinated cigar lounge here in the basement in Billings.
Some might say it's a little too early for whiskey, so I'm but apparently I had heard that actually it's apparently, you know, if I wanted to have whiskey with my cigar right now, apparently the FCC, it's against FCC rules to actually consume that while you're live on the over-the-air broadcast. So now I know. I guess
I
no longer
have a dated reference, but I guess this, you know, would have outlawed Wolfman Jack, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the other legendary DJs from back in the day.
Yeah, it was so cool. So I was in Great Falls, Montana, back in October, and had lunch with some of our radio friends after the show. And one of the guys said, he said, you know, my favorite show that you did this year, he said, this was just the coolest interview you did this year. He said, you had the guy on your show who found Hunter Biden's laptop. He said, that was just fascinating. Well, of course, we're talking with him right now, Richard Minotaur, the CEO of Zenger News, also award-winning investigative journalist, written some New York Times best-selling books, including the first biography of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind. But, yeah, for those who missed that conversation, I can't even remember when that was, sometime earlier in the year or maybe around Christmas last year. You told us the story about how you found Hunter Biden's laptop. So refresh the memory for some of our listeners who either missed it or just, you know, want to hear the story again.
Yeah, this is a great story with many great lessons in it. So there is a computer repair store in Wilmington, Delaware, run by a legally blind albino man who's about 5 feet five. I'm not going to say his name, because he's been doxxed and attacked, and he's been through a lot. But this small man had a tremendous amount of courage. And under Delaware law, if you leave something to be repaired, including a computer, and you do not pay for it, and you're given multiple bills, and 90 days go by and you refuse to pay those bills, it becomes the property of the repair shop. So the idea that the Hunter Biden laptop was stolen is absolutely false. It was dropped off by Hunter Biden, who showed up drunk and smelling of marijuana. He had three laptops in his possession, not one. And it's important to know how you repair a computer, a damaged hard drive or what have you. Step one is that you attach wires to that hard drive, and you make what they call an image, a complete copy of the internal dynamics. That way, when you begin your next step and you begin physically taking the computer apart and repairing it, if you damage it, everything is preserved because you have a complete image, a complete copy. And he takes in all three of these devices from Hunter Biden. He gives him a receipt. He asks for the man's name and address. He does not recognize Hunter Biden. The very drunk Hunter Biden says, you don't know who I am. And apparently this Mac repair store, which sadly no longer exists, and I'll get to the why it no longer exists in just a moment, this is the only Mac repair store in Wilmington, right? There aren't a lot of Macintosh places, an industrial town that has seen better days. And if it weren't for the Amtrak stop in Wilmington, there'd be very little hustle and bustle left in that town. Changed economics and government regulation have flattened the futures and fortunes of the people who live in Wilmington. So I'm not denigrating the town. I'm just saying I don't think any of your listeners will want to buy a vacation home in Wilmington, Delaware. And so he repairs all three computers. And he does not hear from Mr. Biden. His computer, the debit card he gives him doesn't go through. He repeatedly contacts Hunter to pick up his computers and to pay him. And the, you know, short, legally blind albino man who was gifted with fixing Macintosh computers needs the money to pay the rent on the store. There's not a lot of money he makes in repairing computers. Frankly, most people with money these days They just buy a new computer, or they bought the warranty to begin with. So it's not a business that makes a lot of money. And now I'm about to tell you about this small man's courage. He decides to take a look at the image, the copy he made as step one of the repair process, and see if he can find any other addresses or something to contact this guy, because he needs to collect the money to pay the rent on the store. And he quickly realizes that what he has on this laptop is evidence, he thinks, of criminal activity. And he's terrified. Is he now about to become an accomplice in a crime? I mean, there are... As he begins to look at the image, he realizes this is more than just a couple of laptops. Hunter had hooked up his iPhone, his Apple handheld phone, and his iPad. In fact, all of his devices, and the devices of his wife, and the devices of one of his wife's daughters, to the cloud, and it had all downloaded into the, or it was all available for copying in that laptop. And he realizes that he has got a complete electronic copy of Hunter Biden's world for the previous 10 and a half years. He has his credit card statements, he has his debit card statements, and he has thousands of pictures and videos. And these videos and pictures tell a very sad story. The press has grabbed a few of those salacious pictures of the president's son with various women paid to accompany him, and stuck with those. But when you look across these pictures and these videos, you see a deeper theme. In one set of pictures, you see a picture of Hunter Biden's teeth. And he clearly has what everyone knows as meth mouth. A horrible, jagged canyon of teeth. Filed away almost like predator's teeth, like wild animal's teeth. And then the next picture, he has paid thousands of dollars to have his teeth capped, and he is as shiny as a toothpaste salesman's teeth. And then he writes this message to his father with these two pictures attached, the before and after, and he says, "Daddy, do you love me now?" And the saddest thing about this is Joseph Biden's response. And he didn't write, almost anybody listening to this would say, "Oh, more than ever, son," or "I'm so glad you got your teeth repaired," or "You know I've always loved you," or something like that. Instead, Joe Biden, and I think this reveals something about the relationship between father and son, but it also tells us something about the human character of the President of the United States. He writes back, quoting without attribution, the main villain in the first two seasons of Game of Thrones. "You are blood of my blood." That's kind of a non-answer to a sad question for a son who was never the favorite son. The favorite son was Beau. Even Joe Biden, President of the United States, admits this. Beau is now dead. Hunter marries Beau's wife after Beau's death and begins a life with her, and is clearly in the course of the, and it's documented in the course of this hard drive, campaigning for his father's attention and love. And you begin to wonder whether all the business deals they've done around the world, getting various shady characters in foreign lands to give millions and millions of dollars to Hunter Biden, who has never really completed anything in his life. Sure, he graduated from college, but he didn't complete his career in the military. He got kicked out. These companies that he starts, he never sees them through to completion. And this incomplete guy who has problems with drugs and loyalty to his wife, constantly campaigning to get his father to love and care for him. And so, rather than snicker at the Hunter Biden hard drive, I found it to be a deep, open mouth sadness.
Yeah. On top of course, criminality and the allegations surrounding that, and the hunt, and the Hunter and Joe Biden family all around. And then I saw it was really weird. It was kind of like a weird twist to the whole story. When the Biden family put up Christmas decorations at the White House, I think they put stockings above the mantle for all the grandkids, but one of Hunter's kids did not have a stocking at the Christmas decorations at the White House. So it was just another, in knowing this story that you just shared, once again, just wow, what a family, shall we say.
Yeah, there's a lot of dysfunction and drama there. And then I see that James O'Keefe from Project Veritas has gotten into a lot of trouble for coming into a possession of a diary that he didn't publish, but it was since published by another organization. I think it was called National File, if memory serves, some name like that. And this is the diary of Hunter's sister that she kept while she was in rehab.
I'm also very interested in hearing about this de Tocqueville conference. Your wife, Allison, was telling me that you both got to travel. She's the Montana gal that you luckily got to marry, and so great family here in Montana. So that's why we're lucky to get a chance to talk with you here from time to time. But
yeah, she grew up here in Billings.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And her dad's just a great guy. In fact, I saw him at the governor's ball here recently. She was telling me you guys were at the de Tocqueville conference. You spoke at the de Tocqueville conference in Normandy, France. What was that like, and what all did you talk about?
So over the years, I've become friends with a guy named Jean-Guillaume de Tocqueville, who is the lineal descendant of Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America, which is still, you know, a book written in the 1830s, still well-read today, taught in colleges, and it's a story about a friend. It's a true story about a Frenchman, Alexis de Tocqueville, who travels across America in the 1820s and early 1830s. He gets a grant from the French government to study the American prison system, and I think he goes to one or two prisons. But he's mostly a landed aristocrat from the flatlands along the coast of Normandy, is where his family lands are. The village they live in is also called Tocqueville. The family has been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And his journey across America, he writes in this book, Democracy in America, and he speaks to everyone. Tradesmen, frontiersmen, people building the first schoolhouse in the village they just chopped out of the woods months before. He talks to Indians in canoes. He talks to everybody. He spends years learning who we Americans are. And that book, Democracy in America, becomes this great summary. You know, sometimes it takes an outsider to see us clearly. And the things he says are still things that resonate about America today. Everyone looks with despair and depression today and thinks how horrible things are. On the left, they think we're all going to be destroyed by climate change. On the right, everyone thinks it's going to be cultural collapse or something. I've always been much more optimistic about America, and I think if you read Democracy in America, you'll become more optimistic about the future and the character of our people. And his lineal descendant, Jean-Guillaume de Tocqueville, is the caretaker of the castle to this day. He lives in Paris with his family, of course, and he practices intellectual property law, like so many people, he has one of these symbolic jobs. It's hard to explain what you do. You move paper around, really. But in the summer months, when he is able to be out of the family castle repairing things, walking fence lines, overseeing how the animals are kept and so on, he's back in that French reality. And once a year, he holds a conference on his land and invites leading intellectuals from across Europe and the United States. And people have a completely wide open conversation. There's no political correctness. There is no topic off limits. People are expected to be civil to one another. But it's one of these last places of free conversations.
I was going to say, in other words, you won't find this on YouTube, most likely, because they won't allow this type of free thought on a mobile viewing platform such
exactly.
as YouTube right now. Right.
Exactly. I think a few snippets have snuck their way onto YouTube from somebody's phone, but we're all trying to find out who that was.
So yes. Given this wide-open environment, what did you want to bring to the table, or what ended up, or what did you think was the most fascinating thing that was discussed at that conference?
Well, I got into a bit of an argument at one of the panels with the president of Agence France-Presse, the AFP. That's sort of like the Associated Press of France, right? So this guy's the president.
And it gets picked up a lot in America as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
They've got a seat. In fact, I remember there was an AFP photographer that had a seat in the White House motor pool. Every time I was in the White House motor pool, they would have a seat in there as well.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And they cover the U.S. Congress, and they also put out content in Spanish. And so the president of the AFP is on stage, and this is another character named Jason Miller. You might remember him from the Trump White House. And he's now running something called Getter, G-E-T-T-R. And, I told him I thought that social Getter sounds more like a social media service for Bill Clinton. But he didn't think that was very funny for some reason.
He didn't get a laugh at that one.
I thought he would, you know. And we got into a big fight about the nature of journalism and speech restrictions. And I said, look, it's a very dangerous society if you start banning topics of conversation, if you start saying certain things are too rude or mean to discuss. Because a country, like a family, either deals with hard problems and makes the best solution that it can, or it ignores those problems and they become worse. And then they become the thing that everyone's afraid to discuss about because that problem seems insurmountable. And in some families, people will not talk about certain topics because there's an abuser, a parent or an older sibling who is so aggressive that you just tiptoe around these topics. And these speech codes are a bit like dealing with an abusive relationship where there's just certain things you can't discuss, certain words you can't use. And our job, I think, as journalists, is not to respect these private deals not to use certain words, but to talk freely and boldly and honestly, but also humbly, about what is actually in front of us. I mean, the famous George Orwell quote, some days the hardest thing to do is to see the nose at the end of your face. You just got to acknowledge the truth, the reality in front of you. And this was, again, about the Hunter Biden laptop. The AFP president was explaining why they didn't cover it. Oh, it was, and it was more that he picked up the attitude from some of the left-wing journalists in the United States. Rather than having a reporter investigate it himself. Well, we don't know if this was a dirty trick. It was just something made up by the Republicans. And I said, well, there's a complete forensic copy. Remember, to repair the computer, you have to make a copy called an image. There's a complete forensic copy that was made by the owner of the repair shop. You could have taken a look at it. You could have done some independent reporting yourself, Mr. AFP, and they didn't do it. Also, I should tell you that brave, small Obano man turned that over to the FBI in 2019.
Wow. So even a year prior to the 2020 elections, because we didn't hear about it until, I think, until the New York Post story came out and they got banned by big tech, got banned by Twitter, Facebook, elsewhere. In fact, speaking of the Hunter Biden laptop, Mike, one of our listeners, I think he's in Bozeman, but it didn't say which town he's listening in. But Mike asked this question on our Montana Talks app. Do you feel that Hunter Biden should be prosecuted for what is on his laptop? For what was on his laptops?
I'm not a lawyer, and I don't like to make legal judgments. If one were looking for crimes, you can see video of him using various types of drugs. You can see him exchanging cash for sex. You can see some girls who are questionable whether they're of age to be on video. And that would be possession of child pornography. And there are, we believe, we had a former FBI person screen everything using a computer program and exclude anything from the laptop before we looked at it. of a pornographic nature because we did not want to be even accidentally in possession of child porn.
Yeah, Richard, great to have you once again here with us on the show, doing the show live from the Summit Cigar Lounge here. I'm going to fire one up in a few minutes. The media, in just the way that they've set certain news stories off limits, no, we're not going to talk about Hunter Biden's laptop. No, we're, I mean, everything, all of these, the Russia collusion hoax that they went with, the stories they will go with that ended up being fake news, they still haven't turned back their Pulitzer Prizes for the fake news Russia stories against Trump. And then you have the FBI lawyer who was lying on FISA court documents to be able to spy on the Trump campaign and associates, gets off with probation. He's already been reinstated by the D.C. bar, even though his probation time isn't even over yet. I mean, it just seems like the fix is in across the board.
Well, certainly they don't like accountability. I mean, but look at the bravery of the shop owner, the albino, small albino man. He goes to the FBI. He's in the 2019 June. He approaches them in June 2019. He then writes to various senators he sees on TV watching the impeachment proceedings. He writes letters to these senators and says, "Hey, I've got this laptop that shows that the President Biden, who's making not even nominee Biden, but former Senator Biden, is guilty of all these Ukrainian connections and Russian connections himself, right?" And these letters get ignored by the staff at four different U.S. Senate offices. Oh, some local crank. And they don't follow up. And he goes to the FBI, and they kind of just take a copy of this stuff. They call him about a week later, trying to get the password to get into some of these things. But they never follow up. And if law enforcement had actually done its job, if these people had done what they'd sworn to do when they took the oath of office, the Democratic Party would have been spared a candidate in Joseph R. Biden who was flawed. And they would have had a real primary, which maybe the party insiders wouldn't decide who the Democratic Party nominee is, but the Democratic voters would have certainly decided.
And now we see what a disaster the Joe Biden presidency is. I mean, there's a big guest opinion column in the Wall Street Journal today talking about how, look, if you're just some crazy old codger in the Senate rambling and getting off, they just think it's cute when a U.S. senator does it. But now he's the president of the United States. It's a disaster.
Well, you see the guy who phoned in during that live stream call and said, "Let's go, Brandon." And President Biden, said he agreed with it and repeated the phrase. I didn't laugh. I felt sorry for the United States of America to have our leader, who should terrify Russia and China, who should be a tower of strength for our allies, who should be a beacon of reassurance for the American people, feebly repeating a phrase which his aides all knew, standing 5 feet away, meant the most vulgar dismissal of the President of the United States. If there is a better picture of the lowness of that office, because they didn't have an open debate because big tech shut down the Biden laptop business, the Democratic Party nominated somebody who is really not good for their party. The country has a paralyzed president who's probably not good for the country.
We got a great guest with us here today, Richard Miniter. In fact, my friends in Great Falls told me, "Hey, you one of the coolest interviews you did earlier this year was with that guy talking about how he found Hunter Biden's laptop." Well, Richard Miniter was a war correspondent back in the 90s. He's written for the Wall Street Journal and a number of other publications. New York Times best-selling author, written books about terrorism and the 9/11 terror mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and so much more. He's now the CEO of Zinger News, and he's back here in Montana. Yeah, Richard, you were telling me you've got correspondents all over the world,
yes,
all over the country here. But as a result of running this news operation, you also talk to news publishers around the country. So you kind of get to hear what's really going on behind the scenes. Anyway, great to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you here in the Summit Cigar Lounge in Billings. Look, we have Zenger has a very large network, more than 300 news outlets as customers taking our content around the United States, and a lot of those are African American publishers. And as a result, we talk to some of the biggest African American publishers in the United States on a fairly regular basis. And those conversations, I think, are fascinating because it's a totally different perspective on American life and American politics. And when they get candid, they weren't that impressed with Barack Obama. They wouldn't say this publicly, but they thought that there could have been an entire class of black executives who were appointed to senior levels of government and got those credentials, the same way that Reagan credentialed an entire class of conservatives in the 1980s. And they were expecting that Obama would do this as president, and he didn't do it. There were very few jobs given to black people, especially at the senior-most level, aside from attorney general, in the Obama administration. And they see a repeat in the Biden administration. They said, here, the black vote carried Biden, saved his campaign in South Carolina, and helped elect him president of the United States. And yet they are disappointed that so few of the leaders of the civil rights movement have been appointed to his administration. And he doesn't appear to be listening to them. And one of the things the Biden administration doesn't like, what the black community says, is they are in favor of the wall. They're in favor of the immigration restrictions because it meant jobs for their people.
And I see there was this Politico article. And Politico is, of course, a left-leaning news organization in Washington, D.C. And they had this big story about talk radio in Miami, Florida. And they were just perplexed by this whole deal. They couldn't understand why the Spanish language talk radio, because almost all the stations there are, I think they have one country station. Heck, Billings, Montana alone has four different country stations, maybe five. Yeah, but in Miami, there's like one or two country stations, but there's a dozen Spanish language stations. So in Miami, there's a lot of callers into radio shows like this on the Spanish language stations. And Politico was just perplexed. They couldn't understand why there were all these Hispanic callers into the talk radio programs that were bashing Kamala Harris and the Biden administration. And so Politico and some of the people they were quoting were speculating that maybe it was AstroTurf, that these were Republican Party plants that were planting these bash the Biden callers on the Spanish language stations. Well, then a few minutes later, I see this tweet from former state Senate Majority Leader Jeff Esmond out of Billings, and he shares a PBS poll that says actually Hispanic voters have more negative views of Joe Biden than white voters do. Anyway, Richard Miniter, CEO of Zenger News, you know, you were talking about what you're hearing from editors of African-American papers. There is obviously something that is happening that is changing this, you know, the future of politics and the demographic shift that America has been seeing here.
Absolutely. And I think the Democrats are banking on something that is never going to arrive, which is as this country changes, as immigration changes the complexion of this country, they anticipate that all of these people will vote for left-wing policies. And they forget that many immigrants have fled left-wing countries or have had relatives who had. Venezuela, Nicaragua, Peru, what we now see happening in Chile, and they've just elected an extreme radical socialist in that country, and within the next few years we'll almost undoubtedly see refugees from that country. They've had experience with authoritarian leaders, of the African immigrants as well, and from some of the Caribbean islands as well, and they don't want to see, they've come to America, and they don't want to see a replay of it here. So the hostility in the Spanish-speaking communities, especially those from Venezuela and from Cuba, earlier generations from Cuba, the hostility to these progressive ideas is very visceral. It's not abstract, theoretical, unbalanced, it's not a good idea. It's deep in their emotional gut and in their political spleen, if you will. And that means these are going to be very hard voters for the Democrats to persuade and to unite. And we're also seeing changes in the black community. As the average income rises, as we see an extraordinary rise in black business ownership, perspectives are changing across the generations. If you were a middle-class black man in the 1960s, you most likely worked for the federal government, either at the post office or the federal bureaucracy, or for the state government. That's no longer true. There are a lot of black real estate developers, black lawyers, doctors, and so on. And that is changing how their children look at the world. So the idea that demographics is destiny, which was always an anti-American idea, that based on your skin color, you're going to vote like this. This idea is probably not going to work out for the Democratic Party. And
well,
they might
and
be better off going
to
find
too.
Ideas that really do resonate.
Yeah, and to emphasize the point, it's one thing for folks here in Montana to say, yeah, build the wall, protect our borders. What is a country if we don't have borders and if we don't protect those borders, especially when we see the meth that's flowing in and the fentanyl that's flowing into Montana from the Mexican drug cartels? But there are Hispanic Democrat lawmakers in Texas that have switched parties because they also want to see our border protected. That tells you something.
That's right. There's a border county in Texas that with more than 40 percentage points for Hillary, who went that county flipped and went more than 20 percentage points for Donald Trump in 2020. There is a real concern about immigration, not because people don't like people who look differently than they do. It's that whenever you're involved in illegal activity, you're necessarily working with criminals. And that doesn't just mean human trafficking and drugs, but all of the other gun running, all of the other evils associated with it. And when you allow for criminal control of a large section of your borderlands, ultimately you're criminalizing your country. And you're creating a lot of victims in the process. And look, we do need a streamlined, automated, legal immigration system into the United States. But the left refuses to engage. They think it's all about racism, the dislike of people from other countries who have other skin colors. And it's not that. It's the criminal activity. They refuse to see that part of it because they think those people are going to automatically vote for them.
I know some of you are thinking, wow, he's back at the cigar lounge again. Well, Aaron, you're really enjoying the holidays. Yes, I am. But, you know, but I mentioned this last week that, you know, when I was in, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, really, it was a good cup of coffee and a cigar. That was about the only imbibing that you really got to do in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, and you know, to get around the table with a group of guys or gals, if it was a more of a mixed environment, depending on which base you were at, you know, having a good cigar and getting to finally just unwind with the guys was about, you know, the best of times when you're deployed overseas. And so, I threw out this random question to Richard Miniter during the break. I said, hey, what was the craziest position you've ever been in? Because he was a war correspondent. You know, he did a biography on one of the 9/11 terror masterminds, and now he runs this global news service. So the first one, though, you said we probably can't talk about that one on the air. What was that? That was something in Uganda, right? I was
hiring gunmen in Uganda to go into South Sudan. That's on all the negotiations thereby. Yes.
You know what I love about Uganda?
Great coffee.
Great, very good coffee. The people are very friendly, and there's vegetation everywhere, which after you've been in Djibouti and other places like that, you're happy to see vegetation. Everything is named after Jesus in Uganda.
Yes.
It's the Jesus Corner Store. It's the Praise Jesus Liquor Store. I mean, everything is named after Jesus in Uganda. Anyway, but people are very nice there.
It's a very evangelical country, and people credit Jesus with transforming their lives in that country. And you'll truck drivers, taxi drivers will tell you these stories about who they were before and after. And to listen to those stories of Christian transformation, just amazing.
Yep. So we can't tell the trying to hire gunmen to get you into South Sudan story. So what would be some of the other craziest positions
Let me tell you the story about how a cigar saved my life in Iraq. And in one of numerous reporting trips to Iraq, I was staying in a converted parking garage, which is where the military put journalists in Baghdad. And
which is being too kind to you, I might add, by the way.
Well, it was interesting to see what reporters would actually go. And let me just make a quick, important side note. It was the genius of Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense, to give journalists their own military orders so they could travel with the military. And they opened up this whole program called To Embed. And this changed who covered the war. So if you noticed that in 2003 and early 2004, the media coverage of our armed forces in Iraq was relatively balanced. And then just before about a few months before the election, it suddenly shifted. Here's what really happened. The military was taking applications to the big time, big name journalists, didn't want to embed with a military unit. And so they stayed behind in Kuwait or in Saudi Arabia. And the guys from the Metro desk who'd never get a chance to get a foreign assignment, they went and got embedded with, you know, the 4th ID or Armored Cavalry units or what have you. And they just reported what they saw. They didn't have ideological training about what they were supposed to say. So they just reported what they saw. They interviewed guys. Some of those reporters had were National Guardsmen or reservists themselves. So they understood military life. And then they were quickly replaced in the middle of 2004, an election year, by the big-name foreign correspondents who knew what they were talking about. And they didn't waste their time going on patrols and talking to ordinary soldiers.
And getting the actual facts on the ground, because they already knew this story that needed to be told. They didn't need to go out and get the actual facts on the ground.
And then they hired translators and fixers to work for them who had all been approved by the Saddam regime. Even though Saddam was out of power, they still had these relationships. And I jokingly said to Secretary Rumsfeld, if you just gave every New York Times and every network TV a translator a visa to move to the United States, they would all take it and be gone from Baghdad tomorrow. And the networks and the big newspapers would be forced to hire new translators. And because Saddam is no longer in power, he can't approve the next wave of translators. And just by law of averages, they'd get some honest ones who'd actually say what was going on. But anyway, here's how a cigar saved my life. And you know, there are long, boring stretches in covering a war. It's even more boring than for the soldiers involved who have a duty to stand post and to do things. But you do end up drinking a lot of coffee and smoking cigars in the desert. And it's also a great way to start conversations and learn what's going on, because in this smoking area, all the ranks are mixed up. You will be there with a senior officer and with a low-level specialist. And Iraqi translators and others would come in. And that parking garage I described that we were sleeping on the floor in, just beside it was the Iraqi parliament and its impressive wall of glass windows. And I went outside to have a cigar one early afternoon, beautiful cloudless sky. I was enjoying the moment, the sun on my face, cigar in my hand, and a military officer immediately said, "No, go to the smoking area." And I kind of grumbled. And the smoking area was an 8-foot-high, sandbagged, horseshoe-shaped area, which I didn't want to be in because it stood in shade, and the shade was colder in the desert than that bright sunshine. So I went behind the horseshoe and saw an Air Force guy smoking there and a young woman from the Army. And I relit my cigar, and I kind of grumbled about the Army smoking regulations. But I didn't get to finish my thought because there was an enormous explosion. And those glass picture windows were turned into spears of glass that cut through the Iraqi parliament members who were having lunch on the other side of those windows. And dozens were dead and many others lay dying. And it had been a suicide bomber had gone in. And if I had been standing where I was standing just a moment before, I would have been among the casualties, maybe
wow.
even among the dead.
Wow. So smoking a cigar saved your life.
There
yeah.
you go.
You know, that reminds me of when I was on Camp Ramadi, Iraq. This must have been probably spring 06. And, you know, our unit, we were out on patrol every day. We had our sector of the city. So we were out every day for at least 8 hours a day. If stuff got hot at the end of your shift, you were going to be out longer. That's just how it happened. But I went to the chapel one day. And there was this incredible African-American gospel band that was playing at the church service that morning. And these guys are rocking out. They got saxophones, drums, everything. I mean, it was just incredible. All service members who were doing this on their own time in this band. Well, apparently we took some incoming fire on the camp that morning, and we couldn't hear anything because we're rocking out in the, well, anyway, my unit back at the headquarters, they're like thinking they lost another lieutenant because they can't find me, they can't get a hold of me, and so I come back and they're like, "Where have you been?" I'm like, "Oh, is that the," so anyway, just kind of crazy, you know, here you can be in the middle of fire and not even know it because of a rocking you know, chapel there on Camp Ramadi.
You know what no one talks about is what the ordinary U.S. soldier did to help Iraqis. I ran across so many soldiers in the course of my reporting who had written letters home saying the kids really need soccer balls or they really need socks. And some of them, you know, worked with the Elks Club or the Shiners or some of these other organizations, their churches. And they brought over to Iraq many things to help those kids or to help young mothers. And the media never covered any of it. But the ordinary U.S. servicemen had so much human-to-human contact with the Arabs there. The media would cover it as if they hated us. The other thing the media never said. I wrote about this, but didn't get a lot of publicity at the time. It wasn't for the Wall Street Journal, sadly. But these suicide bombers and these people who made roadside bombs, what they call IEDs, were paid. And U.S. intelligence, military intelligence, actually tracked how much they were paid. And the price kept rising because the U.S. was very good at detecting and also very good at killing the triggermen before the bombs would go off. And they would, when the price would hit a certain number, about $500, it would shift and they would change their type of attack. But the fact that the Iranians were paying for these attacks, these weren't ordinary Iraqis who woke up one day and said they were sick of the Americans. In fact, the ordinary Iraqi, many of them, not all of them, I'm not trying to over-exaggerate here, many, many of them had good personal encounters with ordinary Americans. And even though they were wearing our country's uniform and carrying a gun and sometimes afraid for their lives, they were extraordinarily kind. And don't think the ordinary Iraqi did not notice it.
Well, why do you think, meanwhile, you know, a couple countries away in Afghanistan, tens of thousands were clinging, you know, doing everything they could to pile into airplanes to get the heck out of there, to come here. People all over the world that still want to come to America. You know, you mentioned former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Of course, he had a ranch here in Montana before he passed away. I got to see him speak in Bozeman a few years ago, and it was very, I think prescient would be the word. Because this was before BLM and, you know, the riots in the streets and the George Floyd protests and everything else. But he talked about the attacks on law enforcement and the attacks on our military with the slanted news coverage. And he said that his fear was that every single one of these, a little attack here, attack on a police officer in Kansas, attack on a police officer in Missouri, that all of these little attacks collectively could have more of a negative impact on our country than one big attack like a 9/11. That the weight of all these little attacks, the police officer who decides to retire because he's had enough of it, the young man who doesn't join the military because of whatever reason, that the weight of all of those individual things could be a greater attack on America than one single terrorist attack. I thought that was pretty interesting.
The sum of many small things is never itself small. Everything adds up. It's cumulative. And it's important to celebrate heroes so that you have more of them. And it's important to celebrate sacrifice so you have more of it. And when you deny it, when you denigrate it, when you belittle it, you're right. There are girls and boys who say, I don't want to grow up and be a policeman. I don't want to take on the heavy responsibility.
I was talking with Richard Bennett or Moore during the break here. He and his wife both recently traveled to France for something called the de Tocqueville Conference. And actually takes place at the de Tocqueville Castle in Normandy, France. And so you think about it, this gathering of global thinkers, as I guess how I would describe it, talking about, you know, any issue under the sun. It's not politically correct. It's not like YouTube. You can have conversations about things without being banned or kicked out of the conference. And so I was asking, well, what were some of the big conversations that were taking place? And you made a fascinating point about, because if I could sum up one of the themes from our callers, from the Montana conversations that we've had over the last year, I think one big complaint that Montanans have had in the last couple of years especially is there seems to be two systems of justice. There's laws for us that the rest of us have to follow, but then there's another class of people that don't have to follow these laws. The rules do not apply to them. Whether it's big tech CEOs, bureaucrats in Washington, politicians, you name it. But oddly enough, that was actually a similar conversation that was brought up at the de Tocqueville conference.
Yes, they don't really understand what's going on. They use terms like nationalism, populism, Trumpism, and they have all these isms as if they're organized ideologies based on books written by obscure professors that people are following. And instead, what's going on across the industrialized world, not just here in the United States, but in Europe and Australia, you see the same political fights going on. And that's because, and I'm not trying to sound like Karl Marx here, but there is a class warfare that's emerging. But the two classes aren't rich and poor or black and white. They are the accountable and the unaccountable class. The unaccountable class are your tenured teachers, your civil servants, your tenured professors, the corporate bureaucrats as well, those who are governed by HR departments. And these are people who are insulated from results, right? If you are a small business owner, a rancher, you are involved in a business, you're self-employed, you're involved with business for yourself, you live on results. Without those results, your life's a lot harder. But if you live, if you're part of these, the nonprofit world or the tenured world or the civil bureaucracy world, you don't really care whether the economy grows at 1% or 3%. You don't really care if there are so many regulations that it makes it impossible to do business. You don't really care if the things that people are forced to do are completely useless, because you live in a world isolated, insulated from results and from accountability. But the majority of Americans and Europeans and Australians and so on live in the accountable world, where what they do in their work and in their family has to have positive results, or they don't have positive lives. And they're very much affected by how that works.
And it's interesting because,
and the resentment that's building between these two groups is enormous.
Because the people you were hearing from, they're like, well, what is this populism, this nationalism that sometimes even crosses ideological boundaries between what traditionally is left and right and conservative versus liberal. But I also kind of wanted to use that to paint the picture that here you are meeting with these global thinkers. You're traveling the world, you're traveling the country, you run this, this big news operation, kind of under the radar, though, to a certain extent. And so now let's take that from a Montana perspective. So in some ways, Montana is leading the charge for freedom and for economic reforms, for example. Like, for example, Governor Greg Gianforte, first governor in the country to say that's it with the padded federal unemployment benefits. We need small businesses need relief. We need people. So he basically took away the padded federal unemployment benefits to encourage people to get back to work instead of just sitting at home collecting a government paycheck. And now our unemployment record low, 2.8%. But in other realms, maybe Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is leading in some chart. Maybe Governor Kristi Noem in South Dakota is leading in some regards. What do you think are some policy reforms or just things that we in Montana could do? What could our lawmakers or our governor look to implement here in Montana?
Well, if I think of one word to sum up Governor Gianforte, the word I would say is timid, fearful, incremental, small-minded. He has veto-proof majorities. He could do big, bold things and be a beacon for freedom across the United States. He could improve the economy for the average person in Montana, but he could also light the signal fire for others to follow. But he's not being a leader. He's not even being a follower.
So you think he could be even more bold? Because in some ways, like right now...
In what way has he been bold? You lowered the tax rate from, what, 6.9 to 6.6 or something? You're in the sixes. Look at your neighbors. South Dakota, Wyoming, zero income tax. North Dakota is, what, 2.4, 2.7, something like this. And you're in the sixes. This is a state that is designed like a northeastern state with oppressive labor regulations, a workman's comp system that's out of control, where trial lawyers feast and small businesses cower. These are all the wrong things. This is not designed. These policies that have been imposed by previous administrations are not designed for a Western state. These are the policies of Massachusetts and New York, states that have failed, states that have seen their people flee, their factories close, and fewer lights at night than in previous times. Why would you copy these policies? Why wouldn't you aggressively, intelligently innovate and lead the nation? He's got the votes.
Don't just wait for a second term. So, because some of those political consultant types out there would say, oh, well, you just got to play it safe for your first term and then wait for your second term. Well, First off, that's never guaranteed. I mean, it's likely, but it's never guaranteed. But in some ways, you know, the vaccine freedom, we've gotten a lot of attention for that, House Bill 702. And so that's why, thankfully, our nurses and doctors haven't, you know, been kicked to the curb over vaccine mandates. I mentioned the padded federal unemployment benefits, but you're saying there's a lot more categories where we could be a lot bolder. And the governor and this legislature has that opportunity in the next legislative session, depending on the 22 elections, right?
Why not pass a law making it illegal to fire someone for what they write on social media or what jokes they make around the water cooler? Why should corporate HR departments be able to bully and fire and harass people for speaking their mind? Here we are in the West, where people have been free for over a century. Why shouldn't that freedom continue to the workplace? Why should kids be disciplined at school for making jokes on social media or making comments to their friends? You know, we need a bill freeing people to have free speech in the workplace and in the schoolhouse.
And
that's something that if the governor pushed that, that's something that would get the attention of the nation.
Yeah, great to have you here at the Summit Cigar Lounge. Thanks again for them for hosting us here for another very interesting conversation. 2022 midterms, what do you think it's going to look like here? Well, what's just 2022 itself going to look like? Because, you know, a year ago, everybody was like, yay, it's the end of 2020. Can't wait for the new year. And then 2021 started, and it's like, oh, brother, here we go again.
I think one of the sleeper issues of the 2022 congressional midterms is the pandemic-related issues. I think people have just gotten sick of this. And here in Montana, of course, you're not masked up, but there's still many places in this country. And, of course, every airplane, you have to wear a mask. I was fascinated to see the CEOs of two major airlines, including American Airlines, testified in Congress last week or the week before and said, you know, they're HEPA air filters. They suck all the air out of the airplane and bring in new heat up. They bring in new air and heat it up and put it into the cabin every 2.5 minutes. And let's just say the air at 30,000 feet is pretty clean and clear. And there's no microbes that can live at that cold temperature that high up, generally speaking. And then the next session of that same congressional hearing, the head of the flight attendants union got on, and she was very much in favor of the masks.
Wow.
And what this tells you is places where the unions are still in control, airlines, transportation in general, schools, healthcare facilities, these places are still heavily masked up, and they still want to fire people who refuse to get vaccinated. They want to force the wearing of masks and so on. And this is becoming a huge political issue as people want to live their lives and go back to normal. And I think that's going to be one of the issues, the silent sleep issues, which the media won't cover, but the voters will certainly talk about.
Yeah, when I flew back to Montana from Vegas from the National Finals Rodeo Cowboy Christmas, from the leg from Seattle, the flight attendant there was her last, and you could just tell how she was kind of sad to leave her job, but she's had it, she's done. They, you know, they just extended the mandates once again, and she's like, so she had actually joked about how halfway during the flight she was just going to run down the aisle, throw her mask off, and yell freedom, you know, just run down. So, but it was kind of a fun flight because she was just joking around the whole time. But how many different, you know, industries out there have people just said, I've had it, that's it, I'm done, we're out, it's over. And this Omicron variant, really, I was talking, in fact, Dr. Peter McCullough is going to be in Montana in January speaking for the Big Sky Liberty Alliance. He's been on Tucker Carlson. He just did 3 hours on Joe Rogan's podcast. And he said, I just wrapped up a phone call from India. He says, Omicron has blown through. He said, they should be welcoming this as good news. But the elements that want to continue to control us have to keep the bad news going.
Right. They like to create emergencies because emergencies require emergency powers. And that gives the unaccountable class enormous influence over how we live our lives. But the answer to this is democracy. These officials should be elected. They should have to stand before the voters periodically, have their performance reviewed, and give the voters a chance to give them a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And people who talk about science, there is also a science, the wisdom of the public. Now, individually, the public might be not the best educated, but collectively, the public crowdsourcing information can be incredibly powerful. That's how markets work, and that's why, generally speaking, the best way to analyze American politics is to assume that the majority has a point, that there is some wisdom in what the majority wants.
Only a couple minutes left here. We had Ted in Billings call in, asked a question to our producer, Travis. Anything that can be done to prosecute Biden and those violating our immigration laws? Can a president and his administration break laws with impunity? Was Ted's question.
Well, that's a tough one. Generally, you don't want to be in a position where you're criminalizing politics, because that'll go both ways, and we'll quickly discover that politicians of both parties will end up going to jail. And we will, and the law enforcement will become a political arm, as we've seen in other countries. And that's a very ominous, worrisome trend. That said, we have to look at the Biden family, the Clinton family, and the McCain family. Each of those families have set up foundations that receive money from foreign governments or from foreign business tycoons, or closely tied to the governments of those foreign lands. And the question is, why are foreigners giving so much to foundations of those politicians? What do they expect in return? Are they, in effect, being bribed by foreign governments? And that is more than criminal. That's a constitutional crisis. And I think we need to ban the collecting of foreign money by U.S. politicians or their spouses.